Hello and welcome to another episode of Marketing Room 101. I'm Ben Norman, your host for this commute, dog walk, bath or whatever else it is you're doing. And in my day job, I'm Strategy Director at Principles in Leeds. And in this podcast, I invite marketers for a good old rant and give them the chance to banish one thing from the industry forever. This week, I'm chatting to Gillian Clark, founder of Brave North and the marketer in charge of the Honey Monster. I've known Gillian as a client for a long time, as she's pretty much worked for every great Northern FMCG brand. Think Fox's Biscuits, Kit Kat, Quality Street, Wham, Honey Monster, and that's not all of them. What I've always liked about Gillian, and the reason I was keen to invite her into Marketing Room 101, is that there's simply no ego, no jargon, and no nonsense in her approach. I really enjoyed this conversation, and I hope you do too.
Gillian, welcome to Marketing Room 101.
Thank you for having me.
No problem at all. The pleasure is all mine. Before we get started, just to set the scene for our listeners, would you mind just describing what it's like down here in Marketing Room 101?
Oh, it's our own particular version of hell. Marketing Room 101 to me would be like an achingly trendy nightclub where only certain people can get in. It's a dark place where no one really knows what's going on. And it's got a lot of people doing sneaky things in corners, trying to appear as cool as they possibly can. So it's where all the tactics would hide, you know, kind of not wanting to share what they're actually doing. The place where everyone's phone is glued to their hand, because that's the latest thing, that you can't go anywhere without your phone. It's where the style is over substance and there's a lot of words being thrown around, but no one really knows what they mean.
Sounds quite seedy.
Yeah, I imagine it would be.
The music's so loud.
Yeah.
It drowns everybody out.
It drowns everybody out. And it's not the greatest place, but it is Marketing Room 101, so you'd never expect it to be all sunshine and roses and puppies, would you?
Never. And this is probably not even the scariest one we've had, but yeah, it's definitely not a place I want to spend much time.
No, we'll get out there as quickly as we humanly can.
Okay, so you've pretty much completed the north of England as a marketer, I think. You can claim that title. You can stick the certificate up on the wall, because your career has spanned Northern Foods, Fox's, Nestle, Tangerine. You've included brands like Kit Kat, Aero, Quality Street, Wham, Dip Dabs, Sherbet Fountain, most recently Honey Monster. I suppose what I wanted to know is, where do you think holds the fondest memories for you over the course of that career?
Oh, now there's a question. And I like the idea of, you know, I've done the North and I've got a certificate. I should maybe put that on my wall in my office. Where do I look back on the fondest memories? I mean, I've got a load of fond memories. One of the greatest things about what I've done and what I've loved about marketing is I've had some amazing brands to work on that are in lots of people's homes, and people have loved them and they're very passionate about them. I think probably my fondest memories actually would be very, very early in my career working for Fox's Biscuits, looking after Crunch Creams and the Classic Bar and all those wonderful brands. I think mainly because I was an assistant brand manager. It was my first brand marketing job. It was absolutely brilliant. And there was an endless supply of biscuits. I mean, seriously, it's like I think I've bought my friendships over the last, you know, 25 years, because I remember just behind my desk, there used to be a room that was filled from top to toe with biscuits. And when I was going to go and see friends at the weekend, I was in my early 20s. When I was going to see friends at the weekend, I'd literally go and talk to the lady who ran the sample room, June, and be like, June, I'm off. Can I have some biscuits? And then I'd come back with carrier bags full. So there was obviously that perk. But I think it was just the fact that I got to learn what it was to nurture a brand, what it was to launch a brand from scratch, what it was that brand management day in and day out kind of involved. And I think, to be fair, I kind of went in somewhat naively, not really understanding what brand management was all about. And it was great because I got to learn about all these brands that have been around for decades and what it takes to make them thrive in a new century, in a new era, all while drinking tea and eating biscuits.
I like the idea of buying friends with biscuits.
I bought friends with biscuits, chocolate, you know, cereal.
There's a thread here. Yeah, when I read back through the Kit Kat, Aero, Quality Street, Wham, Dip Dabs, your friends have sweet tooth.
It's funny, you know, it's like I spent basically a decade of my career marketing confectionery in one way or another. You know, some people say that makes me the devil. Other people would say, well, that makes me quite happy in many ways. And the irony is that if someone said to me, you know, give me a snack of choice, I'd probably choose, like, you know, a chunk of cheese or something savoury over something sweet. But I don't know whether it's cause and effect, you know. Lots of sweet, lovely stuff I mean, it's been brilliant and I've been really lucky and very, very different brands, actually, I would say, you know, in terms of all those brands, you know, even my time in Nestle, I spent 7 years in Nestle and looked after Quality Street. Then I looked after Kit Kat. Then I looked after Aero in my latter times. And even those three brands in the same company were really, really different. You've got an icon like Kit Kat, which everyone knows and is often quoted and it's got its positioning absolutely nailed and is absolutely huge. And it's really all about making sure that you don't mess that up, quite frankly. And then you've got something like Quality Street that everyone thinks is this icon of Christmas. It is this icon of Christmas, but it's Christmas every day when you're looking after that brand. And that brings with it good and bad things. And you have challenges in terms of, well, how you fight the fight against the competition when you've got piles of tins at the front of the supermarket. Yeah. And, you know, Aero again was really different. Where's its place in the market? How should it be positioned and where can it go? So even within one company, you can have three different brands that have got three very different problems. And you've got to approach them in really different ways. And then, you know, when I left Nestle, I found myself working for Tangerine, looking after the Barrett range of sweets. So Sherbet Fountain, Dib Dab, Wham Bars, Black Jack's Fruit Salads, all those things. You know, I'm a kid of the 80s. I was born at the end of the 70s and I grew up with these. And again, there's that positive latent nostalgia, which when I first came into the business was on the back of quite a disastrous rebrand that had had a horrible, horrible impact on sales. And it was like, right, how do we fix this? And you fix it by putting back all that's great about those brands back into them. And I just think it's a real privilege to take these brands that have been around for so long and kind of be given them and told, nurture them, make sure they're here for decades, centuries to come. And that is a real privilege. And it's not life or death, but everyone's got an emotional connection to these brands. And I think it's fabulous when you can take something that maybe has been forgotten or is having problems and really turn it into a powerhouse again, you know, and hopefully that's kind of what I've then started to do on the Honey Monster, which was obviously one of the brands that I've more recently looked after. So again, as I say, you know, I was a child of the 80s and 90s and you couldn't move for Honey Monster adverts on the telly. Sugar Puffs, as they were absolutely everywhere. And, you know, I now know you look back at the ad spend in the 80s and 90s and I think with inflation, it's like, blimey, I don't think anyone spends that money anymore. But, you know, by the time I was asked whether I'd be interested, it kind of had its tough times and didn't really know what its place in the market was and what it needed to do. And so it was really about how we turn what could have been perceived as a faded icon back round. And that's been brilliant. You know, it's like some people would have shied away from kind of going, oh, heck, look at this. It's a load of mess. How do we fix it? Well, no. What's its place? What does it need to be? How can it talk to people? Is it still relevant as a brand? And actually, yes, we absolutely found it was. We just needed to bring it into this century and make sure that it was really clear, you know, how the brand fitted into people's lives. And yes, absolutely, that meant taking the sugar down from 45% to a level that is much more acceptable.
45%.
Yeah, Sugar Puffs at the height, pre-current ownership, was ridiculously high sugar.
Yeah, 40. And delicious.
Well, yeah. I mean, to be fair, there are still letters that come in going, bring back the original Sugar Puffs. I think 42% sugar, you'd have people bouncing off the walls, which as responsible manufacturers, you can't do anymore. If you want cereal like that, go to the States.
That's the real challenge, isn't it? From looking through your report card here, looking at these brands, it's that responsibility and guardianship to make sure that you're being consistent over the decades and keeping something as relevant today as it was back then, aren't you? If you look at how long Kit Kat's had its positioning for, you look at brands like Quality Street. I don't know how old Quality Street is. Very old, is my guess. You've got Wham Bars, you've got Honey Monster. A lot of the brands that you've managed, you never own those brands, do you? You're a guardian or a custodian for them, and you have a responsibility to respect where it's been.
Yeah, and I think that's the thing. I suppose it's a bit like owning a listed building. You never really, you know, own it. You're just making sure that you don't mess it up too much, but whilst trying to be sympathetic if you're, you know, restoring a Georgian townhouse, for example. And I think that's the thing about brands. You've always got to respect where they've come from. And certainly Quality Street and Kit Kat, you know, were brands of the 30s. You've got to kind of respect where they've come from, but it's not ignoring the current time period or the climate they find themselves in. You've got to make sure brands move with the times and make sure they're relevant. Honey Monster is a prime example. In the 1980s when it was 42% sugar, well, that's frankly irresponsible now. But it's kind of how you balance that guardianship relationship with also making sure that they stay relevant.
So you are today, you're essentially the Honey Monster's boss. What does that entail now? People will, like you say, remember the 80s, they'll remember the Honey Monster back from the days when the ad spend was astronomical, the product was probably top of every kid's list because it was so high in sugar. What does it look like being the Honey Monster's boss today? And how does it feel looking after what you might be able to describe as one of advertising's greatest treasures?
To be perfectly frank, when I got a phone call about this brand, would you be interested in helping them out? It was the fact that there was a giant, big, yellow, furry monster that I grew up with that was around that kind of attracted me to looking after it. So what it looks like now is making it as relevant as it can be. The Honey Monster is actually owned by a privately owned company now. So it's about how we get the brand basics in place to get this brand growing, which it is, and actually growing well. So that can be everything from, you know, what should be our recommended retail in retailer X? What should we be doing in terms of sales promotion? Actually, is our product delivering what it needs to be delivering? How do we communicate this lovable, affable, cheeky chappies nature to people in a way that they are going to smile at and they're going to respond well to? It's very varied. I think the Honey Monster has amazing equity born out of, you know, those years of the 80s and 90s. But actually, what I like to think is that since the brand was brought into its current ownership in 2016, we've worked really hard to make sure that it builds new equity. It's known for being a pretty balanced breakfast cereal choice. It's known for the lovable monster making you smile on social media. It's not the brand that runs his social, the monster runs his social, which can be really fun because we get to have some of the most ridiculous conversations about what he's got up to, what he's doing. I sometimes shake my head at the daily conversations I have about, would Honey Monster do this? Well, quite often the answer is yes. It's lots of fun and it's challenging at the same time, you know, because it's a small brand now with against some really, really big players. You know, we're up against Kellogg's and Nestle cereals. But what I've always said is when you're a smaller player in a massive market, you've got to box clever. And actually, I think that's the real benefit of looking after a brand like the Honey Monster. You have got license to be a bit sharp, be a bit cheeky, and actually do some things that we'll never be able to outspend Kellogg's, but we can maybe be a bit cheeky and cut through.
Yeah, we help you with the social media on Honey Monster. And what I find most empowering is what you just said there, which is the idea that if you have a character behind a brand, you have license to say things that you cannot say if you're just a corporate entity. And I think that the thing that's most interesting about doing so and why I would encourage anybody, whether it's bringing back an old character, whether it's creating a character, if you're on social media trying to get cut through as a brand, you absolutely cannot do that by producing content that is not as good or better in entertainment terms than the stuff that's produced by creators that they're scrolling past.
I think it's Mark Ritson that says, you know, no one really cares about your brand. No one spends so much time thinking about your brand the way you do. I say to James, who's the CEO of Brex, who now own Honey Monster, we're not normal people. And I mean that in the nicest possible sense. But what I'm saying is that we don't look at our brand in the same way as Joe Bloggs Public does. Brands are all about creating emotional connection. And that's entertainment for people. When they're doom scrolling on Instagram or, you know, whatever it might be, they want something to entertain them. I think a character can really allow you to entertain. And I think that was one of the greatest things that we did as Honey Monster. When I first came into the business, the brand was talking as a brand and was like, right, no, actually, we're going to turn Honey Monster into an influencer. And the engagement rates are some of the best I've ever seen. And actually, you know, hats off to the principals team.
So it's interesting you mentioned emotion there. And I think that's something that the marketing world's woken up to. But I do think sometimes the focus, when we say emotion, immediately takes us to a place where something has to be heartwarming or it has to make us feel sad. But making someone laugh is as powerful or more powerful than any other form of emotion. Sparking a little bit of happiness, a little bit of surprise, whatever it might be. And I think that's something that I'm really keen to champion. And it's something that hopefully comes through in the Honey Monster work. Now, you do this work with Honey Monster via your consultancy, Brave North. Do you want to just tell our listeners a little bit about what that is?
Absolutely. So I set up Brave North with a view that all these different brands that I've worked on and all this random knowledge that I've accumulated could potentially be used in other businesses, but really to help people with their marketing. The way I would describe what we do as Brave North is straight to the point marketing, which works. you know, as I said in the What Does Marketing Room 101 Look Like? Marketing to a non-marketeer can sometimes seem a little impenetrable in terms of there's a lot of buzzword bingo goes on. There's a lot of jargon gets thrown around. Fundamentally, marketing's job is to grow your business, and Brave Noor was set up to help people do that. So what we specialize in is what I would call the front end. We'll take a look at what's going on in your business, how you can position yourself, which audience to go after, is your product fit for purpose. We're great believers in those marketing brand basics as foundations on which to grow a business. Yeah. We're not going to sit and write your social media posts for you. What we're going to do is make sure that you understand how you're positioned to grow, help write your strategy and build your foundations so that your business can jump off and really, really grow. I mean, given my background, because I founded it, most of the work we do is with food and drink businesses, not exclusively. But I think the kind of key thing is we want to help you figure out how you put those marketing foundations in place to grow your business.
This podcast is not sponsored by Principles Agency. If it was, it definitely wouldn't be going out a day late like this episode is. But as it's where I work and they give me and everyone else a free day off every week, which I spend doing this, I feel obliged to give it a plug. At Principles, we're obsessed with the word unforgettable, meaning we help everyday brands come to mind quicker and stay there longer. We do this using a set of principles the team and I developed. This means making brands distinctive, entertaining, visible, and consistent. If you'd like to chat about how we can help you with any brand creation, brand activation, or brand building project, just pop me, Ben Norman, or Principles Agency a message on LinkedIn, or head to principlesagency.co.uk.
So you're here today because you would like to banish something from the marketing world forever. Perhaps you'd like to banish a number of things from the marketing world forever, but you've settled on one thing. Could you please reveal what you would like to banish from the marketing world?
So the thing I would like to banish is the idea that marketing is just comms. Absolutely drives me up the wall. If I had a penny for every time someone had said to me, when they ask what you do and you say, I'm a marketeer, and they say, oh, you make adverts then? Yes, I have made some adverts in my time, but not me personally, you know, as in we have very clever creatives and production teams that do that. Or the fact that I'm laughing, but it's not even funny. The number of times where the marketing team has been described by someone who shall remain nameless as the colouring in department, or the girls that make things look pretty. There's a whole heap of what is wrong with those statements, but we've heard them, you know, and they've unfortunately, they've been said in earshot of me in my career. But this idea that marketing is just comms, you know, comms is part of it. It's an important part to a greater or lesser extent, depending on your brand and your budget. But fundamentally, if anyone has actually stopped and spent the time kind of understanding what you do as a marketeer, and particularly as a brand manager, you are responsible for a P&L. You have a top line sales number to hit, a bottom line profit number to hit, and you've got a number of levers you can pull in the middle to get those results. And that, at its most basic level, is, I think, what marketing is about. And the whole idea that it's just comms is so, in my career, I would say probably 10%, if that, of my role has been about communications. You know, it's lovely making a TV ad, though I do remember the very first TV ad. I went on the shoot and ended up standing on the side of a football pitch in Croydon in the rain. So it's not really as glamorous as everyone thinks.
It's rarely the beautiful trips to South Africa for a couple of weeks in the sun, is it?
I know, I've never managed to do that. But yeah, I would say it's only sort of 10% of the job, really. I mean, you're probably gathering that I'm a massive fan. I've probably already said this about 20 times, but the marketing basics. Marketing is about the four P's, and promotion is only one of those P's, and promotion is really where the comms comes in. And even in that P of promotion, only part of that is comms. The other part could be a consumer promotion. It could be promotion from a sales promotion point of view. So there are three and a bit more P's. I think particularly, I mean, I spent 25 years in the food industry. So I think probably the P you spend the most time on in the food industry is actually about product. It's about Again, off-quoted phrases. We're in food. If it doesn't taste great, people won't come back. They'll try it once and then they'll go to your competition. So that whole thing about how you grow a brand and making sure that at every touch point, it really is delivering. If you've got a breakfast cereal, if you've got a bar of chocolate, if you've got a sweetie, making sure that it is tasty or zingy or tangy or smooth or delicious, and it tastes like that every time, it's absolutely critical that the quality is there, the consistency is there. You need to be kind of almost obsessive about making sure your product is absolutely spot on. You know, the Honey Monster, every time I go into the Honey Monster offices, we have a taste panel. We will stand around a kitchen with bowls of cereal and we will go, yep, this is good. No, this isn't. Right, we need to make sure that this is better. So that whole idea of product is so critical. And then that kind of builds into the other piece that are so much of your job, you know, place. Should you be on shelf in Sainsbury's, as I said, or the corner shop? You know, how should you be there? Actually, as a marketeer, you're responsible for writing a really, really compelling sell when you go and talk to retailer X or retailer Y as to why they should put that product on the shelf, how it's going to actually deliver sales, margin. Place becomes incredibly important because we talk as marketeers about mental and physical availability. Well, comms does the mental availability. It prompts people. But if people know about you but can't find you on a shelf where they think you ought to be, or can't find you online where they think you ought to be, you're adding to nothing. So, you know, you've got product, you've got place, you've got price. Now, price is an interesting one as a P, because I hear of other marketers in other industries who don't really get involved in product or pricing, but certainly every FMCG marketer, that's a really important part of their job. So you'll talk about, right, have you got the right pack size? Is it the right price? Right, what margin do you need to make? What margin does retailer X need to make? How does that work? Does that work with our manufacturing costs? And so all these kind of skills that you've got to know. I think this idea that it's all about comms.
I don't understand how a business can operate without marketing. And obviously they do. And there are certain successful businesses that operate by being product orientated rather than market orientated. But without the marketing function, doing the research, finding out what people actually want, what's missing from their life, what are the jobs to be done? How can you develop products without that understanding? Yeah. I don't know. But equally, without an understanding from the consumer, from the market, of what people are willing to pay, are we charging too much? Are we charging too little? How often is it that we're actually charging far too little for our product or service? It's interesting you've mentioned marketing needs to be seen as the full 4P lineup at a time when the elephant in the room is HFSS. Mm-hmm. It's talked about so much, or so few marketers seem to have a handle on the HFSS challenge because we're thinking of it as a comms problem. And if you think of HFSS, but comms is a problem because that's what's been attacked. But equally, what's happening in retailers with relation to HFSS? And then that leads into product. How do we adapt our product in a way that means we can get it placed in certain places in supermarkets, or we can still actually have those listings to defend the P of place? How does it influence the price that we're able to charge because we're having to do all this MPD? So it's such a challenge of all the 4Ps. And I think unless you are looking after and responsible for all 4Ps, HFSS is going to be a massive head scratching challenge.
Yeah, I think that's the thing. You know, it's obviously one of the biggest challenges all round. I'm just thinking about, you know, the example of the Honey Monster and the team that I'm working for there. HFSS is less of a challenge for Honey Monster because, brilliantly and not accidental, Honey Monster is actually HFSS compliant because of the nutritional profile of it. And so that's great, because actually that means that the sales director, Andy, can make sure that he is talking to retailers about that. He is making sure that we can get placement in places that other brands can't. As I say, that's not been accidental. There's a lot of work has gone into making sure that the sugar level has been reduced. It's a high fiber product. And I think you're right. If there are marketeers that aren't responsible across the 4Ps or haven't got a place at the table to talk in the round about those 4Ps, I think it could give them a real challenge. And as I say, I kind of ladder it back up to what I see as marketing in its most holistic sense. You are pulling the levers that you can to make sure that it does what it needs to do and it thrives. I've said this to you before, you know, the reason I love what I do is the variety it brings. And I think saying that marketing is just comms is just missing out so much of the rest of the role. What I would say, though, is, I mean, comms is part of it. So that's knowledge you also need to have. You know that you need to be able to communicate your brand in a way that resonates with the audiences. So what I'm not saying is ignore comms. You need to make sure you have the skills to brief the experts, brief a communications agency, understand what the brand problem is they need to help you solve, understand how you communicate that. You need to be able to assess creative ideas that come back, which is a real skill in itself. Does this meet the brief? Actually, is this going to be noteworthy? Is it going to stand out? All those sort of things. So you absolutely need to make sure you've got the comms skill set. But I think the point I'm making is it's not to exclusion of everything else.
100%. I think a great example of this people might see nowadays is when you walk into a supermarket now, what did Snickers do when they all of a sudden couldn't put products next to the tills? Did they go on TV and try and increase desire for Snickers, try and convince people to go wandering deep into the store to Convec? Or did they decide that instead we're going to develop the, I can't remember what they're called, the Snickers Triple Treat or something, which is a healthier product that carries the Snickers brand that just slips under the threshold so you can stick it near the tills. It's a wider consideration of the whole problem, isn't it? Actually, that's a place challenge.
Yeah.
It's a product challenge, but also we need to be able to do so at a price that people can grab as a quick snack on the way out. So
Exactly. It's
considering that whole problem. We're going to throw a fifth, but the P that sits above all this is, let's start with the problem and let's use, like you said right at the start of this, we have all these tools. We have four tools, not just one.
Exactly. And I think, you know, as a marketer, you are a problem solver. What is the problem we're solving? What's the problem we're solving with consumers? What's the problem going on with this brand? How do we solve it? How do we solve it better? How do we solve it smarter? And that's really how your brand succeeds.
So if I take from you and keep in here, we'll call it marketing as just comms.
Yep.
That's going to be banished now and that's going to stay here. How does that make you feel?
Oh, fabulous. Absolutely fabulous. Banished forever. Thank you very much.
That's now locked in. While you're here, is there anything you'd like to take back that you think is here either intentionally or by mistake? Something you'd like to return to the marketing world?
So it's interesting. We were talking earlier about emotion. And you said that the mistake's always made that emotion needs to be about something being heartwarming or something that needs to be, you know, make you smile, but actually making you laugh is very important. And I think one thing that has potentially ended up in Marketing 101 that I would like to pull back out and return to the industry would actually be emotion. But what I feel is that there's been a real move, certainly I would say in the last decade, about putting the proper rigor into marketing, which I'm absolutely all for. So I'm not saying remove the rigor, but what I think has been lost a bit is the emotion in marketing. It's all become about measurement. It's all become about effectiveness and efficiency. And can we measure that? Can we measure the ROI to the nth degree? Are we 100% certain that that will work? I once had someone say to me, a managing director say to me, can you guarantee me, Gillian, that that will 100% work? And I had to say no. I said,
can you ever?
No, well, I don't think you ever can, but I was like, based on my X number of years of experience and all the pre-testing and all the research we've done, I'm probably higher than 80% certain that that will work, but I can't be 100%. Mm. And I think there is a danger that marketing has got very clinical, and if you can't be 100% sure that something is going to work, you will not do it. And I think that means that emotion and going with your gut sometimes with a background of, you know, the right rigor has been lost. So I've been doing this for 25 years now. I think your gut's built on experience to a certain extent. So that idea of if you have an emotional connection, be it positive or negative, if you see something and think that's brilliant, or you see something and you think, oh God, that's awful, then sometimes pay attention to it. I once made a TV ad, which I look back on, and all the pre-testing told me it was absolutely fine, hit the right metrics. It didn't feel right. And we made that TV ad and it ran for the 5 weeks we ran it, and it has never, ever been aired again. And it didn't do the great job we needed it to do as a brand. And I think I probably knew that. And I think it's really important that you remember that emotion and that emotional connection is what you're trying to create with a consumer. And so when you have an emotional reaction to something, pay attention to it.
It's interesting you say this. In a recent episode, I was speaking to Trevor Robinson, the man behind, along with his creative partner, behind You've Been Tangoed, and he was talking about a similar challenge where we're obsessed with pre-testing, we're obsessed with rationalising, almost to the point of trying to build a rule book for advertising. And all those things are good, aren't they? All of those things are needed. We should use all of those things. But let's not forget our gut, and let's not forget that sometimes you cannot guarantee. Sometimes it needs a little bit of magic.
Yep.
Sometimes you can't quite predict how the public are going to react to something. I think, interestingly, what you said earlier about can you guarantee 100%? And it's like, well, I absolutely can guarantee you 100% if we do nothing, this brand will decline.
Yes.
Anything beyond that, I can't give you any certainties.
And I think it's really important, because one of the things I'm really passionate about is helping the next generation of marketeers. And particularly when you've got younger marketeers, you want to support them in a way that allows them to take calculated risks. So teaches them the rigor, but then actually gives them the opportunity to kind of go, all right, well, shall we see what can happen? I mean, what is the worst that can happen? Most of the time in marketing world, no one's going to die, you know, so...
Very rarely.
You hope so. So actually, how you make sure that going with your gut, trusting your gut, doing the rigor to make sure that you're not just taking a complete flyer, but at the end of the day, it's not exact science, as you say, you know, balancing the heart and the head, isn't it? And making sure that you can create an environment where people feel empowered to take risk.
I think what's interesting is we talk about rigor and we talk about analysis, optimization, and efficiency, effectiveness, and all these things that we know are really important. But is there so much focus on measurement of the activity that we've distracted ourselves from actually researching the consumer? You know, everything seems to be after the fact. And the after the fact monitoring, great, really important. But how much time do we spend also looking at our audience and really doing the research there, and really aiming to understand the audience better, to inform what we do, rather than just measuring it afterwards and looking to tweak or optimise or learn from that?
Well, as I said earlier, it's like we're not normal. When you're in this world, we don't think like normal consumers, you know, but it's our job to make sure that we bring the voice of the consumer, get to understand them, take your blinkers off, take your bias away, and actually go and understand them. And then if you do that, quite often the answer is not rocket science.
Really?
It quite often goes and just appears, because you've done the graft and you've done the hard work to understand. Everything else is relatively simple.
I think that's a perfect place to sum it up, I think. Well, there is one question before we go. So to summarise, I guess, we're going to put marketing as just comms into Marketing Room 101. And I might describe it as taking out trust in your gut. And I think that's a good way of summarising it. Obviously, it's about trusting in emotion in comms, but also your own feeling towards something. I think trusting that gut instinct. But there is one super fan of this podcast, and that is my brother. And he doesn't work in the industry, but he does beg me every week to ask a question. So his question that he has sent me to ask you is, imagine Madison Square Garden, big pay-per-view heavyweight boxing match. Honey Monster is squaring up to Tony the Tiger. Who do you think wins the fight, and what music would Honey Monster walk out to?
Brilliant. Absolutely love that question. Well, absolutely, hands down, Honey Monster would win that fight. There is no doubt about it.
Big guy.
He's a big guy. He's like, you know, several hundred pounds of yellow fluffiness. You know, it's like...
If he's 700 pounds, a tiger's probably 300-400 maybe.
Yeah. But, you know, I definitely think Honey Monster would win that fight. I mean, Tony the Tiger's getting on a bit as well, you know. So maybe past its boxing prime. But what would he walk onto? Well, Honey Monster is nothing if not cheeky. So I reckon he would walk on first, and he would literally walk onto Eye of the Tiger.
Brilliant.
That's Survivor, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah, Eye of the Tiger, Survivor.
Just to really wind up.
Yeah, just because Honey Monster loves winding people up.
I love that. Okay, we'll wait to see if that comes out. It'll probably be less surprising than some of the pay-per-view fights that have come out recently with some random influencer against another. So we'll wait for that. In the meantime, if people want to speak to you, Gillian, how can they get hold of you?
So easiest way is look me up on LinkedIn, Gillian Clark at Brave North, or drop me an email, gillian@bravenorth.co.uk.
Okay, Gillian, thank you very much for coming in.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
So that was my conversation in Marketing Room 101 with Gillian Clark. If you enjoyed it, could you please leave a review wherever you get your podcasts? It turns out most people have no idea how to actually do this, and neither did I. But on Spotify, you just need to head to the main Marketing Room 101 profile page and click the About button. On other channels, your guess is as good as mine.